My name is Greg Peterson. I am the president and one of the founders of the Robert Jackson Center, which we created in 2001, which was an opportunity to advance the legacy of Justice Robert Jackson, a Supreme Court justice who was appointed in 1941 by President Truman, and he was from this area. The design of the Jackson Center is to advance the legacy, and you might ask, why bother? Why bother advancing the legacy of Justice Robert H. Jackson? If we had taken a poll of our area in Chautauqua County, Jamestown, New York, probably 10 years ago, and said, are you aware of Robert Jackson? Most folks would have probably said yes. Aware, and most folks would have said he was a justice of the Supreme Court, not sure when, and he had something to do with Nuremberg trial, not sure what, and that would have been probably the corporate knowledge of Justice Robert Jackson, and I fit myself into that category. I'm a practicing lawyer in Jamestown, doing this for over 30 years. But I had that same sort of lack of knowledge of Robert Jackson. Hopefully, after 7 years of the Jackson Center, people can start answering that question of who was Robert Jackson. Because during this period of time, we've had folks here from Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. We've had scholars. We've had members of the court at Nuremberg. We've had members of the international tribunals, Luis Marino Ocampo, Hassan Jallo, those who are the chief prosecutors of current day tribunals. We've had members who are part of the civil rights community who've been here, such as Nicholas Katzenbach, such as John Lewis, such as Ophelia Delane, James Meredith, and Linda Brown. We had Linda Brown here. And we had the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education at the Robert Jackson Center. And we had Linda and Cheryl Brown together with the entire group of law clerks who participated in the Brown versus Board of Education case here. First time ever. It was a hoot to have these top high-flying lawyers who, at least for a period of time, a year or so, working with the justices who were grappling, I mean grappling, with the whole matter of the issues brought up by Brown versus Board of Education, as we all know, was five cases merged into one. By a little bit of historical serendipity, the case of Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, happened to be the first one filed. It happened to be that Oliver Brown, the father of Linda Brown, happened to be the lead plaintiff of that particular case of Brown versus Board of Education. Yet there was a little gender bias at the time. It was not as if Oliver Brown was the first in the name of alphabetizing the parents who were signing on behalf. In fact, he was the only male in the group of what otherwise was 10 other female or mothers who had signed petitions. In fact, there was a Mary Brown, who therefore probably should have gotten before Oliver Brown. But since he was the only male, he was named the first. It was Linda Brown's dad. And as a result, when it all of a sudden combined five cases, Brown versus Board was the first. So you sometimes, a little bit of serendipity, when we hear Linda Brown, we hear Brown versus Board of Education. That's the background. That was the rest of the story. Nevertheless, Linda Brown was here. So we got geared up. We got geared up for a whole year's worth of activities here at the Jackson Center. You're asking yourself, why? And the reason is Justice Jackson was one of the members of the court, one of the nine members of the Earl Warren Court grappling with the issue of Brown versus Board of Education. Tourjay, how does he fit into all this? Serendipity. 2003, annually, they have a book sale at the James Prendergast Library. It's a big book sale. It's terrific. And you got to get there early, and you got to be aggressive, and if you want to get certain books. And then there are those sections within the library where they kind of have the little higher-end items that you sort of pay some attention to. I'm going to make a confession that one of my, rather than fight the crowd, is it's good to know Catherine Way. Catherine Way is the executive director of the Chautauqua Cattaraugus Library System, and as a result, she's also the James Prendergast Library Executive Director, and she seemingly knows what's maybe under the counter or the good stuff. And if any of you do this, even tell her that I'm talking about it. I'm telling this for a story, folks, so don't take advantage of this. But I would call, usually the day before, and say, you have any good stuff? Well, she said, I'll check. She called back, and she said, I've got this book, and I'm not sure what I have, but it's inscribed on the inside to RMS, Have a Good Vacation, RHJ. This might be your guy. I'm thinking, I'll be there. So immediately stopped what I was doing at the office, moved my way quickly to Catherine's station. And there, you got to know Jackson's J is very distinctive. I said, that's my guy. You now have me. Just tell me how much. She told me how much. We bought it. Now I take it back to the office, and I now am just kind of focused totally in on the autograph. This is Jackson. This is our guy. It's at a book sale, Jamestown, New York. This is cool. So I get back. I wonder, who the hell's RMS? No clue. So I call the biographer of Robert Jackson, John Barrett. John Barrett's at St. John's University School of Law. He's the Elizabeth Linnae Fellow at the Jackson Center. He knows his stuff. And I said, I just got this book, initialed by RHJ, our guy. And he said, well, tell me more. It says to RMS, have a good vacation. Who is it, John? He goes, duh, it's Ruth M. Sternberg, his secretary. That's terrific stuff. So now you've got a book signed by Jackson, given to his secretary, who's obviously going on a vacation. And now the next question he asks, what's the book? And the book is Buttons In, LB and Tourjay. So that now in 2003, your mind starts going crazy. By the way, the inscription was dated 1932, just to give you a sense of timing. So a book sale, James Prendergast Library, book initialed by Robert Jackson, given to his secretary, a book obviously he'd read and given to her to read over the vacation by LB and Tourjay, Buttons In. I figured there's more to this story. So Kathy Crocker, who some of you may know, was asked by me in anticipation of our 50th anniversary commemoration to do some research. Enter the McClure Museum. Kathy goes up, rifles through, finds lots of the stuff which, you know, Mark talked about earlier today, Mr. Olson had written about earlier, and started it and put it into a monograph. A monograph which she prepared, which deals with specifically, starts off with the story of the book, and then is entitled Chautauqua County Lawyers Oppose Segregation, the Robert H. Jackson, LB and Tourjay Connection. Compiled for the Robert H. Jackson Center for the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. And she ferrets out for the benefit of that particular conference, the connection. And for me, it was so much fun to have an opportunity to talk to an audience which was jam-packed. There was Nicholas Katzenbach, the attorney general who was intimately involved during the stare down. Now, you know, everybody has seen the picture of George Wallace. You know, behind the podium, there's the door, Alabama, basically never. But what you don't see is the picture is a cropped picture. You only see half of it. The full picture is Nicholas Katzenbach with a federal order saying this will happen. So Katzenbach is in the audience. Subsequently, I interview him, and it was such a hoot to know this. Again, the story behind that particular picture, that particular scene, it was all staged to give George Wallace an opportunity to showcase a little bit. Katzenbach was there. He served the order. Wallace stepped aside, and the rest is history. But to have him in the audience, to have all the law clerks, and to have Linda Brown, Cheryl Brown, all here, so that I had an opportunity to talk about this connection. And where you have Elby and Tourjet, and I can't even pretend with these two super scholars, which was just terrific this morning. Thank you, Carolyn and Mark. But for me, a lay person who didn't know who the hell Elby and Tourjet was when this was started, to find out that, in fact, and oversimplistically, the bookends of Plessy versus Ferguson, which everybody knows the name, Brown versus Board of Education, everybody knows the name, but to recognize that right here in River City, Chautauqua County, you have Elby and Tourjet representing Homer Plessy. And over here, you have Robert Jackson, who's part of the court that, in fact, overruled Plessy versus Ferguson. This is Chautauqua County at its best. So now you peel it back and you find out this information that, in fact, Jackson, during the cases which were running its way through the court, he didn't know much about Elby and Tourjet either. So he sought it out. He had that intellectual curiosity. Next thing you know, he asks his two favorite lawyers, Sam Edson and Ernest Calcroft, here in Jamestown, can you do some research? And sure enough, they go up to Westfield and they do some research. Next thing you know, they write letters which were, most of it was quoted in the various books in the talk this morning, so I won't repeat that. But that now becomes a real factor of the Jackson mindset. And he talks a little bit about it, but all of a sudden, 1950, this is 4 years before the decision, 1954, he's curious about Tourjet. He's curious about Tourjet's brief, and as is mentioned, the language that's in the brief could be language that could be used then, 1950. That's the impression that Tourjet's work left on Jackson, and how neat that they were both from Chautauqua County. That's part of what drove us when we had a chance to do the conference on Brown versus Board of Education, which you all have at least the monograph or program we used during that time period. Again, in an effort to try to answer the question, who the hell's Elby and Tourjet, and why is it important to us, and to James O'Brien and company, and to the folks who've obviously taken up the intellectual and scholastic interest in that. I commend Carolyn and Mark for doing this, and it's just putting Tourjet, a new face on Tourjet. And sometimes time has a way, you almost need that time, that sense of historical perspective. We see that in Jackson's case. As I mentioned 10 years ago, if you took the poll, I'm confident what I told you, it would be true. I think when Jackson died in 1954, after having a career which was the answer to the Jeopardy question not so long ago, named the only man in the history of the United States to be Solicitor General, Attorney General, and Justice of the Supreme Court. The answer, Robert Jackson. A guy who never went to college. No college. never graduated from law school, read for the law, passed the bar at the earliest age possible, age 21, practiced law here for 20 years, and represented from union folks to the highest of corporations. And then in 1934, he accepted the call from President Roosevelt, who he had befriended through his interest in Democratic politics back in 1911. And they kept close tabs of each other. So he went down and became what was now known as the Internal Revenue Service, as its general counsel. First case was handed to him by the administration was to prosecute Andrew Mellon in Pittsburgh. Now, think about that, sports fans. To go and have to prosecute probably the wealthiest man and go into his backyard in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and try him for the civil fraud suit. Well, Jackson was successful. So successful that if you go down to the National Archives, or go down to the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, and you'll see many portraits, and you'll see a plaque that'll say, given through the beneficence of Andrew Mellon, and the country is pleased. The reality is, it was the settlement of the civil fraud lawsuit, where there was actually a verdict against Andrew Mellon. Jackson had won the day. He then became, as I mentioned, Assistant Attorney General, Solicitor General, where Louis Brandeis at one point said Jackson should be made Solicitor General for life. And then he became Attorney General. World War II buffs know about Roosevelt's signing of the Lend-Lease program. Well, it was Jackson actually signing a letter, giving an opinion to President Roosevelt saying you do not need congressional power. So Roosevelt, with that in hand, just simply cut the deal with the British, and the rest, as they say, is history. He became a justice of the Supreme Court, and during that time, Brown versus Board of Education was a part of it. Youngstown steel seizure is probably the one that gets as much attention, simply because that was the one where Jackson articulated the powers of the executive. Guess what? That's a pretty hot ticket right now. And Jackson's opinion in the steel seizure case gets quoted over and over and over again. Much more so today than while he was alive or after, shortly after he died. Barnett versus West Virginia versus Barnett is a huge case on civil liberties that dealt with the Jehovah's Witness flag salute case. It's just sort of the watermark. It gets quoted over and over and over again. And Korematsu during World War II, the Japanese-American internment camp issues, all of which is his life and the interest in Jackson parallels very much Tourjé's and what Carolyn and Mark are doing, because it takes time. It's now more than 50 years after he's died. All of a sudden, he's quoted over and over and over again. He was the focal point of the confirmation hearings of Roberts and Alito. They kept saying, who's your hero? They kept referring to Jackson. So much so the New York Times actually ran a full page, in essence saying, who the hell's Robert Jackson? Which was great, because guess what they pointed to? If you want more information, go to www.roberthjackson.org, and that's us. It was perfect. We couldn't have asked for anything better. Next thing you know, you got Milosevic. Next thing you know, you got the Hussein trial. Next thing you know, what happens? They say, let's try them. What's the model we're going to use? Nuremberg. What's Nuremberg? They learn about Robert Jackson. Next thing you know, all these tribunals are set up. Next thing you know, they're talking Jackson, 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 Jackson. It's perfect. So from a timing perspective, it's really interesting that as hopefully Carolyn and Mark, you'll be embarking on the new Tourjé Renaissance interest. The same thing is happening here with Jackson, and then the same thing, obviously, there's a connect. There's a wonderful connect between the two, both Western New York people. Both spoke a lot at Chautauqua Institution. I left out here, and I'm sure John has it in his archives, but let me just read this article that appeared in the New York Times. It's dated August 20th, 1888, and it's entitled 1888, so get your arms around the date. That's before Plessy. but after Fool's Errand and his other publications. And it's entitled, in the New York Times article, Our Debt to the Blacks, Judge Tourjay's Lecture to the Chautauqua Assembly. Byline, Chautauqua, New York, August 19th. The most eloquent and the strongest lecture of the season was given last night by Judge Elbian W. Tourjay. His subject was our greater national debt, which he asserted to be the debt we owe the Negro race. At 10 cents a day, he said, the forced work done by the blacks on American soil would amount to over $11 trillion. He spoke in burning words of the intuitively great robbery of the name, family, life, education, and religion which the nation had wrung and withheld from the blacks. Judge Tourjay made a masterly plea for the education of the colored race. His arguments were the summaries of a lifetime of study of the subject, he said. Quote, candidly, I do not think the American people will give the blacks the opportunities they now need or pay any considerable part of the debt now due. 1888, same kind of argument, same kind of issue, which was in front of Jackson and the other eight justices during Brown versus Board of Education deliberation. This is the same podium off of which Jackson spoke seven times at Chautauqua. And his first speech after the Nuremberg trial publicly was at Chautauqua, July 4th, 1947. And there not only was this connected, sometimes, again, you stumble onto stuff when you do the research, and there was a letter in 1950 from Jackson to a friend, which he talks about Tourjay. And if I can find it quickly here. Where in essence, after, said this, here's Jackson in a letter he wrote in 1950 on Tourjay. He came to my county to spend his last years, a rank Republican county, completely dominated by the Grand Army of the Republic posts in an atmosphere that was no doubt congenial to him. He was regarded as quite a fellow. He wrote a local novel based on the Mormon trek through our county on their way to from Palmyra to the west. After the death of his daughter, I recall going with some other lawyers to the auction sale of his goods to see if there was anything in his library that we wanted to pick up. I can't remember that any of us found anything worthy of the effort. I have taken the pains to look hastily at the brief he filed in the Plessy case, and I would say, from what it indicates, that he may have deserved better than the biography. In this case, this was the Hamilton's Dictionary of American Biography entry in Tourjay, that biography indicates. As brief go, it was pretty good. So this is, again, 1950. Thank God there are you folks who are doing some extraordinary work on Tourjay, but it indicated a connect, a real connect. Another connect, and it was a question asked by John Jackson to both of you with regards to parallelism. And the question is, what about the fact that there is things which may have occurred which all of a sudden may run out of gas? And in 1947, Jackson gave a speech to the United Jewish Appeal at the Waldorf Astoria. April 15th, 1947, not quite a year after the conclusion of the war. And he talks a little bit about the fact of the principles of Nuremberg and that it's more than just finding and the conviction of those perpetrators, many of them downstairs, depicted on the walls, and that now that conviction has occurred, that in fact the message is not lost over time. He was gravely concerned. He also was concerned during his speech, and there was a little bit of an interesting recognition, where he says, "We know that our minority problems are not fully solved." So he's talking about our country at the time, 1947. "But we know that persecutions and discriminations are not sanctioned as a matter of law, but represent a departure from the fundamental principles of our government. We recognize opposition to the existing government by political means as a civil right." And he wanted to, he compared that to obviously to what was going on in Nazi Germany at the time, that the trials, which led to the trials. And in fact, that all of those oppositions were just single-handedly and outright disposed of. And he went on to say that the Nuremberg Principle and the persecution of minorities, for him, were crimes against humanity, and that all the four nations joined in prosecuting them as such. "We cannot lack with indifference upon the expansion of absolute power over the lives and thoughts and political actions of people without departing from the principles of the founders of our government, as well as abandoning what we stood for at Nuremberg. The moral position of the United States will not be very strong if 5 years after the war, all we can say is, we saved you from Nazi concentration camps, from Nazi slave labor, from Nazi tyranny, only to admit that others whom we helped to come in have reestablished that same infringements of freedom." It struck me as I was reading that almost at the same time those questions were being asked by John of you folks, this whole idea of parallelism, and even as we think through many of the concepts today. I went through briefly the Reader's Digest of Jackson's biography. I did not go through the fact that in 1945 he was appointed by President Truman to be the chief American prosecutor at the trials in Nuremberg. And it was there, just kind of cool to think about it, that here's a guy from our area who never went to college, never graduated from law school, was responsible for meeting with all of the Allied countries to decide, one, whether there would be a trial, because Stalin and Churchill thought it would probably best that they simply find the top Nazis, execute them, and let's move on. We've had enough of war. Down to the United States saying, we better document this for all time. Because if we don't document this through all time, through the evidence which may be gleaned at the trial, we may, in fact, repeat this. So we actually convinced the Allies that there would be a trial. Two, what would the trial look like? Since you had four governments, four separate legal systems, you had to convince them of what it would look like, so they had to set the parameters of the trial. Where would the trial be? There's a lot of conversation as to whether it be in Nuremberg, Berlin, et cetera. And at the same time, who the defendants would be. They didn't know who that would be. And so Jackson actually signed the treaty on behalf of the United States of America to have a trial. To have a trial and to actually administer that trial. So that's kind of neat to think that you can pick up the treaty, this four-country treaty, and there's Robert H. Jackson from Jamestown, New York, never went to college, never graduated from law school, here. And next thing you know, the trial is conducted. Next thing you know, there are 21 defendants, 18 of which are convicted. 11 were hanged, one committed suicide. Others were sentenced, and three were acquitted. And Jackson was very proud of the fact that, and for him, this was the most meaningful part of his life, was the Nuremberg trial. The fact that it documented for all time the horrors of the Nazi regime. It documented for all times the Holocaust. So that Holocaust deniers really have a hard time dealing with the issues of it didn't occur, or it didn't occur in the magnitude, when in fact the documents proved them themselves. And it's that those writings which have had sort of that everlasting life, it's that philosophy, it's the fact that Jackson really wanted to manifest his thoughts, the world's thoughts, for the long haul, is what in fact is what's endearing today. And frankly, What Mark and Carolyn are doing and what this conference is designed to do is to, in fact, do something which most folks haven't done in over 100 years, pause and reflect on the words of Tourge. And how that seemingly, when you reflect on it and seemingly look at the words, the writings, the efforts, the passion that Tourge have, match up pretty neatly with this passion, the words that Robert Jackson had. And isn't it interesting that they both have a Chautauqua County connection? Isn't it interesting? Their lives revolved around two pivotal cases, Plessy versus Ferguson and Brown versus Board of Education. And isn't it interesting that certainly the curiosity of one Robert Jackson was such that he wanted to learn, as obviously we are here today to learn as well, about one Albion Tourge. So I guess if there's a story in all of this, and that's why we're pleased that this conference is at the Robert Jackson Center, is that there was this connect. There is an answer to the question, who the hell is Albion Tourge? And it's one which we're glad to continue to learn about more and more. But again, like Jackson, Tourge, I think I know more today, at the end of today, than I did at the beginning of today. And hopefully you'll know more about Jackson by the end of today than you did perhaps 7 years ago. So with that, I'll pause. And if there is time for questions, I'll be glad to take them.
You've mentioned several times that Jackson never went to college and never went to law school. So I was wondering, what conclusions do you want us to draw from those facts in the light of his remarkable career?
The part of the biography that I need to fill in is Jackson graduated from Frewsburg High School, which is just down the road. And then he took a 13th year at Jamestown High School. And it was during that time period that he connected with an English teacher named Mary Willard. Mary Willard gave him a 3-page list, of which we have, outlining books that he should read, classics. And when you look at the list, at least I was greatly embarrassed to look at the number of books I had not read. But he read them, and he was tested during that entire year, and he wrote, and he was part of the debate team. And so he was really engaged, and his curiosity for learning, and I guess you saw that a little bit in the curiosity regarding Tourge, was such that it held him in good stead, and that he was curious to the nature that, and frankly, it's part of the Jackson story here, is that story. I'm glad you brought that up, because if you pick up the book, and it's frankly the first biography on Jackson in 50 years, it's for young readers. And why is it for young readers? It really tells a couple of stories, but the principal one is, how did a kid who grew up on a farm in Pennsylvania possibly get to a point where he is an answer to the Jeopardy question right here in Jamestown, New York? And it's compelling. So I'm glad you asked the question. Did somebody plant that? Alice.
I'm curious as to how this place came about. That is, was this an interest you've had for a long time in Jackson? Were there other people involved in form? What made you want to start at Jackson Center in the first place?
I wish I had a snappy answer, and I get this question asked all the time, so I'll just take 2 minutes, maybe more, to put into perspective. I'm an oral history guy. I love talking to folks, because everybody's got a story. And if I had time, I'd interview all of you, because you have a story. And in fact, Vivian Taylor up there, he's got a great story, and he was part of our oral history, as is his lovely wife. They are the seminal components of maintaining Black history here in Chautauqua County, and to the Taylors, we can't say enough thanks. But they were part of this oral history, and Jackson died in 1954. Jackson's funeral was here at St. Luke's Church. Again, I'm a lawyer, and I learned that 8 all 8 surviving justices somehow showed up in Jamestown, New York for the first, and as I've learned, only time where they left Washington en masse. That's a story. That is a story. We're talking Earl Warren, Hugo Black, Felix Frankfurter, and so I then started interviewing attorneys, Sue would know most of them, who were part of that, who went to the funeral because the Jamestown Bar Association, Jackson was a member of the Jamestown Bar Association, sort of were involved and took care of the logistics. Then they had a dinner with all of the 8 justices. Now you can imagine if you're a young lawyer and you're sitting at the table with Earl Warren and Hugo Black and Felix Frankfurter, you remember everything they said and did. And so I captured these stories. This was before there was a Jackson Center. And that was coupled with the fact that we found some pictures and the long story, we found actually a movie in color of the train coming up to the station in Jamestown and all the 8 justices coming out. And you got to say, that's too cool. So we found all that stuff and just gathered. It was, I'm a hunter-gatherer, I guess, which then led to a variety of other conversations, ultimately with a gentleman named Carl Kappa. Carl Kappa, an industrialist here. He was not well, but he was being honored as the man of the year. So I went down to interview him and trying to find out what made Carl Kappa tick. And the question I asked was, as a young Italian-American growing up in Jamestown, New York, in the late 1930s, who was your hero? Who was your hero? Now, I would have bet the ranch he would have said, Joe DiMaggio, right? Come on. Now, he said, Robert Jackson. This was before there was a Jackson Center. This was before Greg Peterson got any affiliation with us. Blew me away. Wait, why did he say what he said? He said it because he felt here was a guy from Jamestown, New York, who was the chief prosecutor of the largest criminal trial in the 20th century, and he had brought himself up by his bootstraps. He's the guy that mentioned the fact he never went to college, never graduated from law school, and here he was from Jamestown, New York, and we ought to do something about it, says Carl. I said, boy, you're speaking my language. Well, that led to other conversations with some benefactors, and it kind of went on a roll. And I really never anticipated we'd be sitting in a theater that the Jackson Center would own. To me, if you were Lucy Desi, on Pine Street, they had a nice storefront, and you walked in and you saw articles and pictures and the story, which was sort of a stagnant story, a little bit of audiovisual. I don't mean that negatively, but it's just that's what I envisioned the Jackson Center would be. Here we are, 19,000 square feet later, and we pretty much filled it out. But that's a very long-winded story. And throw in the fact Sandra Day O'Connor, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, in 1996 dedicated the statue. If you see a Jackson statue, which is down on 8th in North Main, she was here. So again, if you have Justice Sandra Day O'Connor come in and say how great a guy from Jamestown, New York is, all of a sudden you start believing it. And all of a sudden you should probably pause and reflect on it. And that's probably a couple of events which got us going here. I don't know if I answered your question, Allison. I don't know if I can.
A quick point of clarification, if I may. You have stated correctly several times that Jackson never went to college and never graduated from law school. It was misstated a few minutes ago that he never went to law school, which, of course, he did go to law school for a year and then sat for the bar, and I just wanted to correct that.
By the way, John, what was the name of that law school?
Thank you very much. It was Albany Law School, the greatest law school in the country.
And there are two very famous Jacksons from the law school, one Robert, another guy named John. So, yes, here's the story on the law school. I say that as if you get going out like a Baptist minister, you know, never went to college, never graduated from law school. And those folks at Chautauqua who hear me talk about this frequently say, oh, here he goes again. But he did go to law school 1 year, Albany Law School. At the time, he took 2 years' worth of study in one. He was studied for the law, by the way. That's what he did. That's how he was able to qualify and take the bar exam. At the time, he could not get a degree because he was too young. He was age 20. You had to be 21 to even though you may have qualified and taken care of all the requirements at the school. He couldn't get it, so that's the story. Yes?
One of the things that has impressed me most about Justice Jackson was his statement when he was a speaker at the Jamestown High School graduation about lifelong learning, and that impresses me very much because I'm probably the oldest person in the room today, and I feel every day is lost if you don't learn something.
Oh, I learned a lot today from about Torje. Hopefully you did also, so thank you for that comment.
I've been thinking since Carolyn's talk and Carolyn's sort of plotting out the story from of Bricks Without Straw, and from the observation, the question about historical parallels, and I'm struck that in my mind there is a very, very compelling parallel and between the Reconstruction period in America and the aftermath of the victory in Iraq. And because of the conditions that seem to me very, very similar, conditions of ripe for chaos. And I don't really have a question on it. I wanted to make the observation, make the remark, and see if that seems like it's sensible or reasonable to others in this audience.
Maybe that's a great question when the panel gets going here in a few minutes, to have that insight from everybody other than just me. One other connect, and I don't know what the timing's like here, but we recently had the commemoration of the 100th birthday of Thurgood Marshall at the Jackson Center, where we had Bill Plant, CBS White House correspondent, here to talk about his coverage of the civil rights movement. And we had presentations that we gave to Mrs. Thurgood Marshall, which we sent out. And part of the package that was sent to Mrs. Thurgood Marshall, who unfortunately, due to health reasons, couldn't join us that day, but we sent out to was this. This is a copy that was prepared by James O'Brien, who does everything just so first class. And have I said that enough times, James? Do you believe me? I mean, I really, seriously. Yeah. Yeah, he's terrific. But anyways, this was part of what we wanted to send to the Marshall family on the 100th birthday, and we had a chance to celebrate it to the day. You know, it was really quite an opportunity. Was this book, which gave a chance for the Marshall family to see the briefs. The notes that were given for the oral argument, in preparation for the oral argument, as well as some other wonderful items. So this found its way to the Marshall family, as did the book Fool's Errand, as ways to sort of say thank you. From the Jackson Center, we used the Torje connection with Marshall. And that was a special night for us and a special opportunity for us. And that, with that, I'll probably conclude. Thank you very much.